Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast set up in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, ex-Greenham Common and fracking activist, well, she's now a fracking activist, ex-Greenham Common, that is, Frances Leader. Also, former psychological warfare officer for the US Army, that's Scott Bennett, talking about Trump's chances and why some of his best friends seem to beat him going to court. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Frances Leader and I've been an activist for 50 years and now I am retired and living in gorgeous Dorset.
Fran, is it okay to call you Fran?
Yes, of course.
Fran, how did you get involved in activism? That's a long time to be involved. Tell us about some of the things you've been up to over the years.
The first activism I went on, I bunked off of Saturday work when I was 15 years old, and I went to Hyde Park to take part in a CND rally outside the American Embassy. That was in March of 1967. And then from then on, I was always attending anything that was happening with CND. I was particularly upset by the fact that young guys in America that were only a couple of years older than myself were getting murdered in Vietnam. And I found that so appalling. And I was far too young to understand what we were fighting for or what anyone was fighting for in Vietnam.
So do you understand now?
Oh, yes. Now I do. But then I didn't understand what it was about. And so I just objected to war as a whole because I was born in London. And immediately at the back of my house was a bomb crater. And that's where I played when I was a child. I knew what war meant because every other house in my street was bombed out. So the thought that war was going to be continuing anywhere in the world was unacceptable to me.
Okay, so what have you learned since then about the real reasons behind Vietnam?
Well, I have come to the conclusion that, and this is awful, but I'll say it anyway, it's a personal opinion. I think they had so much weaponry left over after the Second World War, they needed to use it up. And so they just picked a place that they thought would be weak and attacked it and tried out all their experimental weapons on that place, including Agent Orange. And in effect, what it was nothing more than an extension of depopulation of the planet. This is my personal opinion.
Okay, well, in between now and then, what else have you been up to?
When I was 20, I gave birth to a child. I'd just got married and immediately fell pregnant and gave birth. And having that child made me much more conscious of getting involved in anything where I might be arrested or sustain an injury because I always had to bear in mind the child. So I had a period during between 1972 and 1977 when I didn't do very much apart from harass my MP and take an interest in politics and geopolitics at a distance without actually getting involved. Once my child reached about five and was able to go to school, then I started to get back into activism again. I had been a member of CND and Greenpeace, and I got involved. The very first one that I got back involved with was I lived in Clacton-on-Sea at the time in Essex, And there was a whale in a swimming pool on the pier. And every time I saw him, he looked sicker and more listless. And I started to worry about him. So I contacted Greenpeace and said, look, I'm worried about this whale. He doesn't look right. His dorsal fin was folding over. And he was very immobile in comparison with when I very first saw him. So I harassed them, and I really did harass them, to do something about this whale. And eventually, what with fundraising and doing barefoot walks between Clacton Pier and Walton Pier and back, eventually I created such a stink and a lot of attention in my town that Greenpeace offered to buy the whale from the pier, but the people on the pier wouldn't sell it. And then eventually the pressure, I managed to create so much attention that the pressure mounted to such an extent that they actually wound up threatening my life, and Greenpeace upped their financial offer, and finally that whale did get removed from Clacton Pier and sent to Miami, where he was treated for cancer, which is what it turned out to have been the problem. Thankfully, he did recover and was put together with a female and resulted in having a child, a baby whale. And so I felt really happy about that. That was my first really major success. After that, I got heavily involved with Greenham Common and went there many, many times. Greenham Common is an American base in the UK, and they were keeping nuclear weapons there. And I just could not see that that was in any way justified, and in fact was turning the UK into a potential target. So I went every opportunity that I could, along with several other women, because it was only women that were doing that camp. The reason for that was because in the early days, the men were being assaulted, not just by the GIs from the camp, from Greenham Common camp, but also from the police and local vigilantes. So we discovered that the best thing to do was for it to be only women, and that discouraged the violence to a certain extent. And we were trying really hard to keep it a peaceful protest, i.e. standing at the gate singing, making artwork on the fences, and generally trying to draw attention in the media, which was extraordinarily difficult, as it is now, with anything where you are objecting to the powers that be.
So did you manage to succeed with that eventually or not?
Yeah, we did. After about 4 years of harassing them constantly, we were evicted from one camp to another. It was really, really bad, and some of the conditions we were in were awful, but it did result in a positive. The silos were emptied and the nuclear weapons were removed.
Well, that's good. What about more recently? I know you've been involved in the anti-fracking campaign. Why did you decide to get involved with that?
My husband worked for BP. He worked offshore on the North Sea oil rigs between 1978 and 1982. Within a few months of him finishing that contract, he started to get ill. And it was very, very subtle illness. But this was a man that was 14 stone of solid muscle. You know, he had worked very hard offshore, physically on the drill. So he was very fit, and he was deteriorating very slowly. And over time, he eventually succumbed to cancer in 2013. And I realized, because all the cancerous growths that he got were all across his chest, it was under the skin, immediately where his overalls were soaked in drill muds. The drill muds that they use to lubricate the drilling are toxic in the extreme. And when they return back up the pipe as they pull the string up to change the drill bits, those muds are radioactive. But the staff that work offshore do not know that and are never told that. And I know this for certain because my husband was not a paper person. And BP used to send him stacks of paperwork all the time. And I read every bit of it on his behalf so that I could alert him to anything important that he was maybe missing. And I can assure you that at no point was he ever informed that the muds returning from those drills offshore was radioactive. But I know now that it was, because since then I have researched and I've got involved in the anti-fracking community, and he is not the only person who has died long before they managed to reach the age where they could claim their fat pension.
Okay, so what about fracking? Why is it particularly that you've chosen to campaign on that, and what are you doing?
That came up at that started at Borkum in July of 2013, so literally a couple of months after my husband had died. And I went to Borkum to see if my experience of the oil industry was of any use, literally just to see if I could be of any help. And when I got there, there was hardly anyone there. It was the second day of the protest. And I wound up sleeping in my car, and I ran the information tent and then became the treasurer for the entire summer, the entire time we were there.
Why are you so against fracking then?
Because of the fact that my husband worked for offshore in the oil industry, and I know that the oil industry is incredibly toxic for the people that work within it. But that was offshore, where all the fluids and solids that would be returning from the drilling were being discharged into the sea. I knew that if they put a similar rig onshore, that the fluids and the solids that would be returning from the drilling would be radioactive and chemically toxic to such an extent that it would cause problems for people in the local vicinity. And when I saw where they were putting the drill in Borkum, it was only a couple of hundred yards away from the nearest home. And that absolutely appalled me. Plus, I don't know if you've ever seen Borkum. It's an idyllic little village with forestry and fields. It's beautiful. And to stick a ruddy great big oil rig and all that entails there is an obscenity.
Okay, what about also, you've been looking at quite a lot of other stuff, haven't you, as well? Particularly, I noticed recently, on the social media cartel, that is to say these big organisations like Google, Facebook, Amazon, who seem to be, Microsoft, Twitter, that seem to be totally dominating the internet, and they're providing their services for free, so they're very tempting to use many of these things like YouTube. But they're not necessarily acting in our interest, because they've suddenly, once they've got a monopoly, then they start to use it. Anyway, what are your thoughts about them?
Well, right from the very first time I ever switched on Facebook, I was completely and utterly aware that all I was actually doing was saving GCHQ a whole load of work, because I was writing my own files. That's effectively what we are doing. Whenever we go online in any capacity, on Google, on Facebook, on Twitter, on any social media, we are writing our own files for the security services. And anybody who doesn't believe that is naive in the extreme.
Yeah, but people will say, well, I've done nothing wrong. I've got nothing to hide. I mean, if someone wants to use that information, that's fine.
Yes, I say that too, that which is why I am quite happy to go on Facebook and say exactly what I think whenever I think it. And the reason I have for that is because I know for certain that GCHQ and MI5 have had a file on me since I was 9 years old, and it has never done me any harm whatsoever. They have never interfered with me or in my life, but they do have some wonderful photographs of me that I would dearly love copies of.
How do you know that for sure?
Ah, well, during the time that my husband worked for BP, he bought himself a Mercedes, a beautiful Mercedes, and he was very nervous about leaving it parked anywhere out on the street. So he asked his friend if he could park his Mercedes in his friend's car parking spot underneath the offices, BP's offices, in Dyce, up in near the Aberdeen airport. And this was no problem. He did that. He went offshore. All of a sudden, a helicopter arrived offshore, and MI5 whisked him off the rig because, by pure coincidence, the Queen Mother was opening a new extension of BP offices in Dyce near Aberdeen, and they had done a security sweep of the entire building and grounds, and they had found this strange Mercedes parked in a car parking spot, and the number plate didn't match the one that should have been there. So they took the Mercedes to pieces because they thought it was a bomb. They collected my husband off the rig and whisked him off to be interviewed, and he was interviewed all night long.
Well, it sounds like an interrogation.
Well, that's the accurate word, yeah, interrogated all night long. And they wheeled in, this is so funny, Tony, you're going to love this, they wheeled in a trolley, and this trolley was stacked with files, and the files were all about me. And they were presenting my husband with information about me, trying to suggest to him that he did not know who I was and what I had got up to in my youth. You know, like, oh, look, we've got photos of her at a CND rally. We've got photos of her at Greenham Common. And, of course, my husband knew all about it, and he wasn't in the least bit miffed by this. And he did actually say to them, look, you've got better photos of my wife than I have. Could I possibly have copies? And they accused him of being an IRA sympathiser. And this was purely because his grandmother was Irish. That's how extremely paranoid, how extremely they think that the most tenuous link that you may have to any organisation that defends anything against the British government, and they will immediately assume that you have some sort of nefarious activity going on there.
You know what? So they sound a bit paranoid to me.
Well, at that point, they hadn't actually finished taking the Mercedes apart to ascertain that there was no bomb on board. So they can be forgiven for being overcautious, I think.
Okay, what about, I know because you've been writing quite a bit about and telling people and sharing information about the war in Yemen. What made you, I mean, what's going on over there, I suppose is the main thing to ask you.
Oh, that started off because a doctor in Yemen got in touch with me and befriended me on Facebook, begging me to put out information about Yemen because it was clear that we were not aware in this country of how much British involvement there was with Yemen. And I wasn't aware at that stage. But thanks to the doctor, I was able to get up to speed and start putting information on Facebook and on Steemit about what was happening in Yemen. And basically what is happening is the Saudi Arabian government is a proxy army for the British involvement and British interests in the area, and it's all about maintaining control of the waterway and access through to the Suez Canal. And it's also, according to the local people in Yemen, they seem to be bombing all the places that are historically significant. And of course that deeply offends the Yemeni people, but it also obliterates history. And this makes me wonder, does that matter so much? Why does that matter so much? And the Yemeni people have been saying for a long time that Yemen is the Holy Land, and that they do have evidence of that. And I think that what the Yemeni people are trying to get across to us is that they are the victims of simply their location. And this has all been smoke and mirrored away by saying that this is to reinstate the previous president, who was nothing more than a Saudi Arabian puppet, and calling the Houthis terrorists, and also claiming that they are backed by Iran, and there's no evidence of that whatsoever. So it's all smoke and mirrors to confuse you so that you don't know what on earth this
is. Well, it sounds to me as if the Saudis, by bombing these sites, and of course the British and the Americans are involved as well, helping them target the sites, I think using satellites, and we've got Royal Air Force advisors over there helping them. Sounds to me as if what they're doing is smashing up these historic sites, a bit like they were accusing ISIS of doing in Syria.
Well, yes, of course, but that's the Saudi Arabian army forces are being used in exactly the same way as the ISIS forces were being used. They are proxy armies working for the New World Order, and at the top of that is Britain and the USA, and of course the Vatican, although nobody ever wants to say that.
Well, what about this term, the New World Order? I'll let you finish on that, Francis. What do you think it's actually a useful term to use? Because a lot of people will say everything that goes wrong, they blame it on the New World Order.
Well, it isn't a New World Order, is it? It is the Roman Empire that has never died. All it did was become clandestine and rebranded itself in exactly the same way as you find all these terrorist groups rebranding themselves with different names. The Roman Empire still rules, and unfortunately the vast majority of our history has obliterated that fact.
Also, I mean, there are people that say that the Americans have been leaking information that they're planning to do. In other words, maps of which parts of the world they want to take over next. Is that true?
Well, I came across a Pentagon document that seemed to fall into my lap far too easily. And when I researched it, it was quite easy to find online. And what it portrays is that they have that they are not looking at the world as a whole bunch of nations and countries anymore. What they're doing is dividing the world into two parts, two very easy to distinguish parts. They call it the core and the gap. Countries that are in the core are countries that cooperate with globalism. Countries that are in the gap are countries that do not cooperate with globalism. And the countries in the core are attacking the countries in the gap. Hence the interest recently of Trump and his warmongers pointing themselves at Africa as a whole. Africa as a whole, apart from the very, very bottom, South Africa, is in the gap. Interestingly, so is Puerto Rico, Cuba, much of South America.
Well, what about the big boys, China and Russia? Are they in the gap or are they in the core?
No, they're in the core.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Isn't it? Very. And so we are, us in Britain, we're in the core, of course. And the countries that are not in the core, that are in the gap, which is illustrated on the map that I found, are all of the Far Eastern countries apart from China, and that includes Japan, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, all of those countries. Then you come across and you skip around India. India is part of the core. And then you skip around and include the Pakistan and Bangladesh. You also include going around the north of that, Kazakhstan, all the stans, all Uzbekistan, etc., etc. All of those are in the gap. And then you swerve back down and it's most of Africa. And it kind of looks like a banner across the middle. If you looked at a map of the world, it's just like a banner across the world. And those gap countries have no choice whatsoever, and neither do the countries in the core, because the countries in the core are going to be attacking the countries in the gap. And we've got two choices. We either kill them or permit them to be migrants, immigrants to our country. And they've got no choice either, because they either defend themselves or die. And this document that I saw from the Pentagon is backed up by one particular chap who is giving lectures on this subject and has been for very many years. And he calls his lectures The Brief. And he's briefing everyone at the top of every military in the core countries.
Well, it'd be nice if the BBC would report on this. Anyway, fascinating stuff, Francis, and I hope to speak to you again sometime.
Thank you very much for giving me a call, Tony. It's lovely to speak to you.
And you, love. Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Scott Bennett, and I'm a former U.S. Army officer, a defense contractor, and a State Department contractor. I was in the Bush administration from 2003 to 2008, and I worked in counterterrorism and terrorist financing and psychological warfare at Booz Allen Hamilton. So I was in the top areas of the government.
When you say terrorist financing, I mean, you were not yourself financing it, I hope.
No, I was in the counterterrorism financing. So I was looking for all of the money, the bank accounts, the Swiss banks, the Saudi banks, the American banks, the European banks that were funneling funds to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, alleged terrorist mercenaries. But I didn't know at the time that we were the ones actually financing and training them from the U.S.
I mean, that's an incredible allegation, really, Scott. I mean, we've heard recently that Qatar has been behind funding some of these terrorist mercenary groups. Jihadi groups. I just wondered, is it just Qatar? Because Qatar seems to fit the media picture of the bad guys. At the moment, there's this blockade of Qatar, and the Saudis and many other countries, the West, usually allied with the West, including the Israelis, are pointing the finger at Qatar and saying, you guys are behind funding ISIS.
I'd say it's Saudi Arabia, first and foremost, absolutely Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia was my country that I studied when I was doing terrorist financing, and I know all of the royal family members and the different foundations that they use. And, of course, Saudi Arabia is the core of the Wahhabi ideology, the bankrupt, lobotomized Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde face of Islam that has nothing to do with any sort of humanity. It's everything to do with convert or kill or enslave. And the American people are waking up, I think, finally to the Saudi Arabian American alliances based on the petrodollar prostitution ring that we've engaged in since the 1970s.
Can you name some names? Are you allowed to do that? Because it would be interesting to know how it actually works. I mean, I think it's quite possible that, for example, through intermediary banks that keep their clients absolutely secret, it's quite feasible for someone to give money to an intermediary country, an intermediary bank, a very secretive bank that will not disclose anything to anybody, that money can then be funneled through. But who and how do you know that who was it in the Saudi royal family and the ruling elite there, of course, because they don't have any elections, that was behind this?
Well, I can tell you some brief overviews. I can't ever talk about things I did in the skiffs in the top secret compartments. But Saudi Arabia, Abdullah Aziz was one of the key figures that utilized Union Bank of Switzerland and the Optimus Foundation. And I'm looking up some of the other foundations I listed in my report, Shell Game, the North American Islam Trust, the Islamic Association for Palestine, Islam in North America. The Holy Land Foundation, of course, Council on American Islamic Relations. These are all groups that were instruments for the terrorist financing and money laundering in the Middle East, as well as the U.S., but specifically in the Middle East.
Now, some of those groups, they sound as if they could almost be legitimate groups.
They are. They've got the paperwork.
But I'm saying that some people, have tried to close down bank accounts, for example, of legitimate groups which are raising money to help, for example, starving Palestinians. And it seems almost deliberate that these kinds of groups you're talking about are being mixed up with the real ones.
That's what they do. They mix them up. They use the starving children as a front, as almost a human shield in the financial economic wars that they yield. So they put up the starving children, and they use that. And when they get the donations, of course, half of it is used for legitimate purposes. The other half is used for buying weapons and advancing Saudis up into, for example, Syria. We've just seen in the cable that was released, which I knew about and reported in 2012, but it's just come out now in 2017, the cable that described the PRISM component of Saudi Arabia Prince Sultan sending mercenaries up into light up Damascus and flatten the airport. If you recall that DIA CIA memo that I think Edward Snowden had in his zip drive that he smuggled out from Hawaii, who incidentally worked with me and my team when I was in Booz Allen in Virginia, in Washington, but that's another story. But that cable confirmed that the Saudi Arabian Prince Sultan specifically ordered and managed and financed 120 tons of weapons to go up and attack Syria, destroy Syria, and remove the regime change. And the United States was part of that. So that was written in 2013, March of 2013.
The whole thing, it seems, though, Scott, has come to nothing now.
Well, it has, thankfully, because Russia stepped in and was the big boy on the block and said, we're not going to allow any of this. We're not going to allow the world
Putin
to become
destabilized. Putin has done this for his own self-interest, surely.
Well, I think Putin did it for the interest of Russia and his people. They didn't want this regime change to cause a complete meltdown and a human tsunami to flood up into Russia or any of the former Soviet republics and cause, destabilization. We've seen what it's done in Europe. We've seen with all these African migrants, refugees, and economic migrants flowing through Libya across the Mediterranean into Italy, into Germany, into Sweden, into Britain, into France. There's nothing good that's come about from this human refugee tidal wave that was caused by the United States. That's what we did. That's what the United States military and the State Department and the CIA did under Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Started, of course, under George W. Bush and the seven countries in 5 years. But the greatest disappointment is that Trump hasn't stepped in as he promised and overthrown those money changers' tables like Christ in the temple. That's what we've been waiting for Trump to do, is to go in
fact,
and stop
that's
all
what
this.
He said. That's what he said in his pre-election campaigning, isn't it, that he was going to do that? But look, he's having some problems, isn't he? Just in the last few weeks, more Russiagate coming to bite him. And can you just take us through the evidence that there is for this and what you think is really behind this attack, if it's not just simply the judicial process running its course in the U.S.?
Well, let's start with the fact that there is no Russia gate. There's no Russian interference in the election. There's no Russian meddling. There was no Russian hacking. And the technical experts who work at the NSA, work at the CIA, work in the Pentagon have confirmed that. This was an inside leak of Democrat National Committee emails that came from most likely Seth Rich, loaded onto a zip drive, then passed on to the English gentleman, I can't remember his name, who then in turn took it to Julian Assange.
Craig Murray, actually, the former ambassador. Actually, I think he would probably take umbrage at being called English. He's very Scots.
But anyway, he's Scottish. Yeah. Oh, very good. Well, he's from my home country.
Okay. So what happened then? I mean, with this information, and how did it translate itself into a massive scandal which has gone right to the top of the courts in the US that is implicating several people close to Donald Trump in actually colluding with Russia to steal data for the Russians and to actually skew the results of the elections?
Well, this is a grand smoke and mirrors operation. This is the Democrats at their highest degree of skullduggery and manipulation and psychological. It's right out of Goebbels' propaganda book. Accuse your enemy of what you're doing. So it started out, of course, with Manafort working for Yanukovych and the pro-Russia-Ukraine government that Obama and Hillary Clinton and Victoria Nuland wanted to overthrow. But here's the interesting thing, Tony. By taking Manafort to court, by charging him with crimes, he can open up the court system and have all of this discovery, all of the evidence of the U.S. coup d'etat thrown onto the court to be examined, because he can say, this is why they hired me. The Russian Yanukovych regime were telling me that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Victoria Nuland were sending CIA snipers into his country. So let the court examine that. So it's going to seriously backfire, and I think he's going to fight it. If they're smart, they'll do what I'm suggesting. But that was the reason that they came after Yanukovych. That was the Russian issue. And of course, Hillary Clinton, we have to look at it from a timeline. The Russian Uranium One deal that happened, Hillary Clinton, the secretary of the State Department, was involved with that, the sale of it. There was an individual that was appointed by Obama who has ties to the Muslim Brotherhood who gave permission for that to have occurred. So there's a lot of things that happened with the sale of Uranium One to Russia that was done by Hillary Clinton, done by Obama. Manafort was in lobbying from 2006 to 2014. It didn't have anything to do with Trump. It had nothing to do with his election. Manafort just sort of came together and said, I'll help run the campaign. I'll be a campaign manager and I'll get you votes. Well, Manafort was a longtime political operative in the Republican Party. So he was brought on board on that basis. But never did the FBI communicate to the Trump campaign that they had a prior investigation into Manafort. Why did they have a prior investigation? Because he was a thumb in their eye on the opposite side, stopping their agenda to overthrow Ukraine. And then the FBI allowed Trump to hire this guy and used that to open up a FBI sting and wiretapping on Manafort and others. Now we see this justification. The Russian dossier that was supposedly written was another element of pure propaganda that the FBI, in fact, had financed to a certain degree. All of that was an attempt, I think, to slander Trump, to throw mud at him. And they've been trying to abuse, connect him to Russia and abusively call him a traitor because, of course, Hillary Clinton lost the election. So the Democrats have been desperately trying to whip up this communist, anti-communist sentiment that somehow the Soviet Union has resurrected itself. It's come back to life. The Cold War's started all over again. And we need to, see Russia as the enemy. That's been the Democrat push to try and manipulate the American people in the world with Rump and the Trump collusion. But it's not there. Bill Binney, Robert Drake, Ray McGovern, who have formed the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, have examined the forensic analysis of the original electronic WikiLeaks, Guccifer hacking and all that. And it shows this had nothing to do with Russia. It was instead a CIA, FBI job. It involved Hillary Clinton, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. It involved, sadly, I think, the death of Seth Rich. I think he was assassinated because of it. All of the stuff you'll never hear on the mainstream media. Thank God we've got people like you, Tony, that has the guts and the honor and the intellectual fortitude to present this information and to analyze it and to simplify it for people to understand. But the Manafort prosecution, which is all related to money laundering and financing and inappropriate banking usage and, quote, not declaring, you know, yourself a foreign agent, things like that, that has nothing to do with the Trump campaign.
Okay. But, what about the whole – because, I mean, this seems to be moving towards – I mean, it's almost like McCarthyism or something. Some kind of firing up of conflict with Russia. But do you think that the U.S. military's really got the stomach for that?
No. I mean, I was talking to a senator today. I won't tell you the name because he wants to keep it private. But I was talking to a senator today who was describing how in Afghanistan it's the American military is just waiting to have a bunch of American military personnel captured and taken as hostages and dispersed in a final defeat of the American military presence in Afghanistan. There's no will to be there. There are a bunch of beat cops standing on a corner smoking cigarettes and just, you know, playing on their iPads. There's nothing there for them to do. So if Russia and Iran and China were in bad moods and really pissed off, they would help the Taliban go in and do an operation and capture a bunch of U.S. soldiers. And the U.S. presence in Afghanistan would be done overnight. They would pull out overnight if something like that happened. Now, look at New York City. They've tried to invent this. I think it's a false flag attack. I think it was artificially engineered with a CIA-FBI hybrid agent or entrapment or something funny because there are too many tells. This is an Uzbekistan person. So suddenly you're going to whip up anger at Uzbekistan that has links to Russia. You're going to whip up the renew the invasion of Syria and Iraq based on this one, quote, ISIS, participant. Funny how he had a paperwork manifesto in the rented truck. They all seem to have this convenient manifesto or suicide note always with them. Of course, the guy, you know, allegedly isn't dead. But
or a passport. A passport is quite often
found. Or a passport, yeah. I think it was false. I think it was a setup.
So how does something like that happen? How can you actually get somebody to do something like that, Scott?
Well, if you're taking a guy with a beard and photoshopping his image to make him look like someone he's really not, and you're not going to have actual real close photographs of the guy, it's easy. You hire him, you pay him $1 million, you promise him a trip to Tel Aviv and a house there, and you get him, and then you get him into a hospital, and then you get him out of the country. That's how I would do it. And you certainly can't trust the mainstream media. They're a bunch of lobotomized cheerleaders that live off of this sort of chaos. You can't trust the military anymore. They're like, as Peter Lavelle said, coke addicts getting free cocaine with all of these false flag attacks. They're getting endless contracts, endless jobs. So I think taking a guy, either grooming him as an actor or taking a individual that's, you know, susceptible and putting him into this role. Mossad is known for doing this in the Charlie Hebdo attacks and some of the Nice and German attacks. Research, you know, that comes out shows the fingerprints of the intelligence agencies all over this. But I don't think it's a real legitimate attack. I think it's been artificially generated for hysteria purposes.
Okay, let's just take a look at what happened in Las Vegas as well then, because many people have said this guy Stephen Paddock, who was supposed to be behind that attack, former accountant for Lockheed Martin, just simply didn't fit the profile. His girlfriend, his family, his next door neighbor even said that he didn't believe he did it at all.
Well, I don't think he did it at all either. I think
his body was found in the room. I don't think there's much dispute about that, and that he had been shot. But not necessarily him, not necessarily being the gunman. Anyway, so can you just sum up what you've made of this Las Vegas attack? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it looks as if it's a bit of a jab at Trump. It's certainly about gun control. But it's also, you know, an attack on this kind of country and Western thing. It does look like a sort of a jab in Trump's direction, saying, look, Trump, you know, don't mess around with us. And of course, it's taking place in Mayalansky, in Las Vegas's mafia country. This is, and we haven't heard any statements from the mafia. The FBI, I wonder, can they be trusted? We have a real problem with the equivalent here in Britain, which is MI5, because they had very close links to all the terrorist attackers without actually stopping these attacks over the last year or so, including the 7/7 London bombers back in 2005. They've been following them very closely, and they went on to do attacks. They managed to get hold of explosives, all this kind of thing, even though they're supposed to be under the closest surveillance. And of course, the FBI have guns. They don't necessarily want the people to have guns. So what's your analysis of what happened in Las Vegas?
Well, the senator that I talked to today, in fact, had said the FBI tried to rope him into this fake terrorist organization. They said, would you please help us get a journalist out of Syria that's been arrested? And he said, well, as long as he's not a terrorist, yes, I'll help him. And the organization, the FBI tried to get him to go and talk to was a terrorist organization on the terrorist watch list. So this same individual had been targeted by the Hillary Clinton campaign for removal in the Senate. So the deep state FBI were trying to entrap a senator by targeting him. And he said, Scott, the FBI and the CIA are the most corrupt organizations. You have to stay away from them. They're very dangerous. I said, yeah, I know, Senator. So we can't trust the FBI, the CIA, or the military. They're dishonest political
Reminds me a bit of what's been going on in the tech giants world. You know, the Google cartel, the Facebook cartel, these guys all getting together to run things. Yeah. People are starting to realize just what they've got there, because they're saying similar things, aren't they, about terrorism and about this kind of that they're skewing their results, etc., to get rid of critiques of terrorism.
Yeah. They're scrubbing the internet too from within. They're scrubbing the internet of intelligence or videos that show the false flag nature of a lot of the stuff, show the hypocrisy. I saw YouTube videos taken down that I had watched before on Las Vegas, and I clearly saw a 3-shot burst fired from a rifle that was 2 floors above the machine gun that allegedly was firing. And this was not on the 32nd floor. This was like on the 4th floor. And I saw it. And whether they were shooting blanks or not is another question. But there were 2 other weapons that were used. So it was not one individual. I'll say I saw the footage of the room where the individual Paddock was found. And the gun, the handgun that he was supposed to have shot himself, was above his head. As if, you know, he's lying on the carpet and the handgun is above his head about a foot. Now, you know, Tony, if you're going to shoot yourself in the head, you're going to drop the gun and fall to the ground. That means the gun is not going to go behind you and above you. It's going to be at your waist. It's going to be lower around your lower body. And there was a lot of very suspicious elements in the room. We never saw 23 guns. We saw maybe, 6 guns that were scattered around. I know firsthand, anybody who's shot with a 5.56 or a 7.62 military caliber weapon is going to have arms and legs and hands missing, going to have their guts ripped out if they're hitting a gut shot. And none of that was present in the casualties that were allegedly caused down in the Las Vegas shooting. You didn't have, 58 people were said to be killed. But you know what you have, Tony, when people are shot with weapons like that? You have people dying a week later, a month later, 3 months later, because of the complications, because of the bullet holes, the size of baseballs that go through them. And none of that has ever happened. You had 58 killed and then 500 wounded and nothing else. No lingering wounds, no people in comas. You don't have a photograph of the bullets that have ricocheted the cement on the ground, that have punched holes in the bleachers or the structures. You don't have any of the forensic evidence of a real mass shooting. So I don't believe it until I see it, until I see the forensic photographs and the autopsies and the paper trail that proves the people existed. They have social security numbers. There's receipts of their entry into hospital. Every person that's taken into a hospital in Las Vegas should have had a sheet that said their name, their wound, and their next of kin. And none of that stuff has been presented. Additionally, the FBI wiped clean all of the phones that people had submitted containing evidence from the shooting of the night. So that reminds me of 9/11, when they cleaned the scene of the crime, when they cleaned down all the metal that had collapsed from the buildings that were not hit by planes, no plane parts being found, and all sorts of irregularities. So we see the same thing. And you know what the common denominator is? Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller is probably one of the dirtiest, most corrupt people in the history of the American government, especially in the FBI, because Robert Mueller was present in the Clinton administration in the 90s. He went against the Waco, Texas branch Davidians. Mueller and Comey are deeply connected with HSBC, the terrorist financing bank that I know for a fact. HSBC was also identified by the Senate as a major terrorist financing hub. Right there, you've got the Clinton Foundation, connections to Comey, connection to Mueller. Mueller has hired attorneys that represented the Clinton Foundation, so there's a conflict of interest. How this can continue, how the American Congress can be so cowardly and bankrupt of real leaders that don't stand up and expose this and call out the hypocrisy as crimes. It is a crime for this sort of conflict of interest, because it wastes taxpayer money.
Interesting hearing from your senator, because, you know, in a way, what we've got here is we've got a surveillance state gone mad. In fact, it's the sort of thing that George Orwell wrote about, because you've now got the potential for groups like the National Security Agency and GCHQ to not only to be spying on your senator friend, but also to be spying on journalists, on editors, on managers and owners of newspapers, on lawyers, on barristers, on judges, in the whole of the judicial system. To say nothing of the, you know, of politicians, presidents, all the people that we rely on in our society for a sturdy democracy are now, it seems, in the crosshairs of these big organisations. And I wonder if there is anything which is you can see, which is where people like journalists, politicians can be aware of what's going on. It sounds like your senator is aware, because you would have thought that in any kind of normal democratic society, he would be able to run straight to the New York Times and they would actually, they would publicize him, they would back him, and they would say, we can't allow this to happen in a democratic country.
Boy, you would hope that is truthful. You would hope that the Washington Post and the New York Times would do that. I recall a personal experience when Michael Isikoff and Tom Hamburger, Hamburger was a journalist for the Washington Post, Isikoff was with NBC News, and they came up and debriefed me while I had been legally imprisoned by the Obama administration, and I reported to them the military report I had submitted on terrorist financing, links to the Clinton Foundation, links to the Swiss Bank, links to HSBC. And Tom Hamburger and Michael Isikoff sat down for 2 hours and said absolutely nothing except, why do you think the CIA would do this, Scott? And that tells me who they were. They were CIA. And they never returned any of my documents. So that proved to me a very hard lesson, that the media is the message, and the message is the CIA intelligence apparatus is in charge of everyone's lives. And if you try and report it, it's just going to fall on deaf ears.
So what does that mean? What does that mean for ordinary people who think, they see on the nightly news, oh, well, the government's running things, the political parties are free to appoint whoever they want, that the journalists can report the truth to us, that lawyers can run honest court cases? It looks like all of that may be a sham.
It is a sham. It's a fantasy. It's an absolute a mirage, and that's how the deep state continues to exist, because it infects the minds of average Americans in the world with illusions, with mirages, with hypnosis that there's a shining city on a hill called America, called Great Britain. We are the paragons of virtue. You know, we are the protectors, the vanguards of all things good, and human rights and human freedoms flourish under us. But then the fruits of their actions, you know, by their fruits you shall know them. The fruits have been violence, ashes, oblivion, destruction, from Libya to Syria to Afghanistan to Iraq. And now we're looking at Russia and Iran. Tony, I'll say the qualification for good, honest men and women is have they appeared on RT? Have they appeared on Press TV? And I'm delighted to always see you participate like the warrior you are when you're on Press TV debates, swinging the sword of truth and taking no prisoners, because that's inspiring when you hear a man who speaks truth boldly and articulately and with facts and reason, not with emotional ideology, not with political brainwashing, not with all of this nonsense that we see regurgitated in the American airwaves of CNN or Fox News or any of the other stations, or the BBC for that
matter. Now, I mean, you've worked in the military. What about your view of where this is heading? I mean, if you were a military commander looking at this, say, where will we be in a year's time?
I think we're breaking into a civil war renaissance where a lot of the military, a lot of the people in the intelligence agency like me, are breaking out and breaking free, and some of them are being very quiet about it, but they are not going down this road anymore that was started with September 11th. It was a complete lie. It took us about 6 to 7 years. It took me. I mean, I didn't really discover that it was a lie until I had been imprisoned and had a chance to sort of, on my island of Patmos, reflect and analyze, and I was given a lot of the information, and I suddenly saw the lie for what it was. And I was so offended and outraged because I put my life on the line. I joined the military to fight this cause, and I saw the cause was created by us. It was
so
all propaganda.
What you're saying is that actually people in the military may know this too, but they may not be making a big fuss about it. I suppose the fact of the matter is, you know, people who are in those official positions can actually, for example, lose bits of paper.
Yeah. They you know, there are things that are kept forever that can be evidence. There's no statute of limitations on murder, and I think the murder that we've done is going to come back to haunt us very quickly. And I hope it happens in an international criminal court where you have George Bush and Dick Cheney and Obama and Hillary Clinton and some of these other actors indicted for the war crimes. If they could do it to Milosevic, they could certainly do it to Dick Cheney. They could certainly do it to Hillary Clinton. For all of the destruction they've caused.
But at
caused.
The moment, it looks like they're doing it to Trump. What's your prognosis for him?
Well, he was elected because he was telling the American people, I'm going to make friends with Russia. I'm going to stop regime change, and I'm going to focus our resources on America first. I'm going to build roads and bridges and fix our country and let the economy grow by a Reagan-esque approach of small government, low taxes, so you can invest in your own lives, your own community. And he's gotten into the podium, and he said he was going to do all that, but then when he got into the Oval Office, he started signing bits of paper that did the opposite.
So what happened? What's happened?
Well, he's either been confronted by the deep state and told they're going to kill him or his kids if he doesn't play ball, which I think is a coward's way out. There are some things worth dying for. There are some things worth standing up and speaking to the American people. He is the president, after all. He does have the bully pulpit. He can make a proclamation on television like Ronald Reagan did. So he's either been bought or he's too ignorant to really be a leader, to really be smart enough to say, I'm going to get out of foreign policy altogether and get back into domestic policy. And foreign policy, there's really not a lot to do there in any constructive way except get the hell out of breaking up countries and sending American military bases all over the world. What do we have, 800 bases all over the planet? We're encircling Russia when instead we should be pulling back.
But didn't exactly the same happen with Obama? I mean, he was when he brought in, we were going to close Guantanamo Bay. He was going to be some kind of wonderful UN Peace Prize activist, Nobel Prize guy. You know, and actually what happened was, for example, the drone killings started to really ramp up.
Well, I don't think anybody's more qualified than you, Tony, in understanding the Bilderberg groups, the Council on Foreign Relations, these globalist sort of entities that seem to have a leverage or a influence or a squeezing grip on these global politicians. And perhaps that explains why some of these career politicians are so easily corruptible. They do speak out of both sides of their mouths.
So why is it that the military seems so happy to go and risk their lives for politicians they know are crooked?
I think they are so well brainwashed that they don't give consideration to the political philosophy, the political theory. They don't analyze things from a social, political, economic context. Some of them do, and they quickly become disillusioned, but they've already had, you know, 10, 15 years into the military, and they know that they could be kicked out, lose their pension, or thrown in, you know, the brig in military prison. So they sort of stand down. Then there are those of us that have went in. I went in as an officer with a direct commission, so I wasn't brainwashed. I went in as a you know, surgeon looking for cancers and disease to purge from the American politic. And many of us who discover this come out, I mean, very, very outraged, but at the same time convicted to fix it. And a lot of military kind of, they don't. They're so brainwashed into thinking America is a cavalier, King Arthur, crusading force for good, that everywhere we step, flowers spring up. Every hand that we touch suddenly comes to life. The leprosy leaves their political, social, national status, and they turn into beautiful fair maidens. That's the touch of America. That's the Midas touch. They are brainwashed into thinking that the American touch is that, and the military are the extended hands that achieve that. It sounds romantically naive, if not delusional, but that's precisely what I'm afraid the American military mind and the American political mind has become, whether it's not because most of these people are over the age of 60, 65, and have all sorts of chemical imbalances and medications and senility and Alzheimer's and statin drugs that they've been taking for cholesterol that eats away their brains because their brains are made of cholesterol. There's all sorts of physiological explanations for why the American military and political class is such a mental retardation.
Okay, well, look,
and
what
I'm
about
not
the
getting,
private
I'm
mili-
not getting ugly,
what about
I'm the, just identifying the forensics.
What about the private military companies? Because they are taking a much, much bigger role nowadays, aren't they? Like what used to be called Blackwater. I noticed with that horrific attack in Mogadishu the other week that it was about 6-7 years ago that Al-Shabaab actually gave a press conference saying, well, Blackwater are over here recruiting. Our information is they want to create massive terrorist attacks in Somalia in order to blame them on us.
Yeah, that certainly fits the model. I mean, you're dealing with Somalia, a town that's bankrupt and backwatered. I mean, I've had friends of mine that were in Somalia in the 90s, and they still have PTSD from the things they saw and participated in with the monstrous ugliness that exists in some of those pockets. I mean, the raping and the pillaging and the violence and the diseases that exist in those people in those parts of the world, the whole personality of some of these Somalis, to think that they are being funneled up into Europe now is absolutely horrifying. I mean, I have a Marine that told me, Scott, I'm still on PTSD because these Somalis, when they would rape a woman in the area of Somalia, and they would kill the woman after that. They would justify it by the Wahhabi theory that any woman that's out there without a man is waiting to be raped, and it's not their fault because a jinn has jumped into the man's soul and caused him to rape. That's the lunacy that's in these guys' minds.
But what about the private military? I mean, this isn't something that seems – it's almost like one step removed from it under any kind of proper chain of command.
Well, they're worse than the military. The private military is worse than the military, Tony, because they are whores of the worst kind that work just for money. And they're already scarred or brainwashed or traumatized from whatever, you know, the wars that they've been to in Afghanistan or Iraq. Since 2001, they're now making it a job. They now think life is a big Call to Duty video game. They now think that they can get, I mean, millions of dollars from creating conflict and strife and fights. And it's like they've been lobotomized. They have no conscience. And there are private military contractors that have been identified as the cause of the Boston Marathon bombing. There are contractors that have been photographed with black backpacks, khaki pants, and boots wearing the backpacks that were identified as the ones that caused the explosion in the Boston Marathon bombing. That wasn't really a bomb. It was a big firecracker. And the Sarnav brothers were patsies. They were set up. They weren't the ones who did this. Those were military contractors who did this.
Well, I noticed that one of the Tsarnaev brothers that was taken into custody naked. He had taken all of his clothes off, and yet somehow managed to get so badly shot up and beaten up that he died. You know, that's so
right.
That's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, that's not
that's
very
right.
good treatment by the police there. And it makes it's rather difficult to think that from someone who's completely naked and being dragged into custody, in a reasonable manner, you know, he looks quite good. He's, you know, he's got all his legs and arms and his stomach, etc. And then to find that the police have treated him in some sort of way to kill him.
Yep, that's exactly right. And he, in the photograph, I can't remember, he had a beard. I think it was in the photograph, he had a beard, and then he was clean shaven or vice versa. So the photograph that they used to justify the official narrative did not match the photograph of when he was taken into custody. And you're right, he was taken alive, he was naked, and then the next thing you know, there's a photograph of him in a coroner's office with a massive gash down his rib cage, and he had been killed. And, you know, that the individuals that were allegedly wounded at the Boston Marathon bombing, some of them have been identified as amputees before the bombing. There's an army lieutenant who had his legs blown off, and he was there are pictures of him before in his army uniform. And then you saw him at the parade in a wheelchair being whisked away by a guy with a white cowboy hat and the American flag. I mean, it's clear propaganda. It's Goebbels Nazi Germany propaganda.
Okay, well,
and
let's
it's
get
an
back
attempt to de-arm America.
Let's get back to Trump. And I wonder if you think he can survive this, Scott. Because obviously this kind of court case and court cases swirling around him are a very good way of putting pressure onto him, almost blackmailing Trump. So to say, well, we've got this and this and this case that might come along. So sign on the dotted line.
The only way he's going to survive is if he completely abandons all of the promises that he made that got him elected and goes the way of the deep state, like another Jeb Bush or another false patsy. In that case, if he did sell out completely, I think he'd be a one-term president because the American people are not going to go that way. They'll be so disenchanted with him that they just won't show up to the polls, and he would lose, and the deep state would win because they'd have John Kerry or someone run against him. Or if Trump mans up and returns to his original promises and hires a new cabinet of very strong-minded conservative people, not neoconservative Zionists, but real conservatives, who will go after these deep state operatives and appoint an inspector general czar that utilizes the inspector general powers of the federal government, then he has a chance. Then he has the ability to investigate the investigators. And that's one thing he needs to do is use the inspector generals, which are a quasi Department of Justice, to investigate all of these crimes. Going back to 9/11, I mean, he could expose Mueller for illegality in the 9/11 issue, confiscating the video cameras, all of the funny business that went on in 9/11. Mueller could be investigated for that. So could Comey. So could Andrew McCabe. So could Weinstein.
Okay.
For going after people.
Let's finish though on a bit of a grim note, I suppose, and that is looking at the situation in the world with the US and the NATO expansion being blocked in Syria. A lot of people have been talking about another kind of enormous kind of false flag style event like the 9/11 attacks. If that were to happen, whereabouts in the world might it be? Would it be at some flashpoint like North Korea? Maybe they be blamed? Who might be blamed? And what do you see that may possibly happen, Scott?
You know, I don't think North Korea is going to take any action. They're not an enemy of the United States.
But they may be blamed in a situation like that. I mean,
but
I think what happens is the West does these attacks and then it wants to pin them on to, and it uses the mainstream press to do this, it wants to pin them on somebody that it's already kind of been building up as a big enemy of the West.
Well, you would think that China and Russia have already communicated to the U.S. that you will not step into North Korea and launch a military objective because we'll step in on the side of North Korea simply for the preservation of its integrity. China did that in 1951. They'll do it again. They've told the Americans that. So I don't think the Americans are going to engage in a fight against Korea because they'd have China and they'd have Russia against us, and we would lose that. Now, are they going to try and do something in Ukraine? Are they going to try and do something in the Kurd Syrian area? That's yet to be. I think their objective is Russia. They've been ramping up the sanctions. Yet another sanction from the Department of Treasury has been listed against Russia. Americans are now forbidden from doing any sort of oil exploration in the Arctic. So it seems, again, really sadly, that Russia or Iran are going to be the next flashpoints. I would probably say Iran, because the Israelis, a lot of people are talking about these attacks in America, like a false flag Las Vegas attack, may have been an Israeli operation, because they haven't gotten the seven nations in 5 years that they wanted. They haven't gotten Syria taken out. They haven't gotten Iran taken out. And part of that is perhaps they're so frustrated by that they're taking it out of the United States. They're trying to send messages, which I think could result in a complete awakening of America against the Israeli Likud Zionist Party. But I think they're going to try and push Iran into a confrontation that would justify a U.S. action against Iran. Trump's already been presenting that. Israel's been presenting that. They're trying to get a Kurdistan split to justify the U.S. going back into Iraq. And it's very sad, because Russia, I don't think Russia can allow Iran to fall. I don't think China can allow Iran to fall, because if Iran falls, then China and Russia are the next to fall in another 5 to 10 to 20 years. They know that.
Okay. Scott, how can people follow your work online? Because I imagine it's quite difficult to find you on the BBC.
Well, I'm on Press TV a lot. I'm on RT a lot. My website is www.shellgamewhistleblower.com. So shellgamewhistleblower.com. And the book is Shell Game by Scott Bennett, a military whistleblowing report on the Clinton Foundation terrorist financing WikiLeaks connection.
Okay, Scott Bennett, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. God bless. Keep going good.
All right. Take care. That's all for this week, Dialex Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And you can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast, if you like, at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, former Greenham Common activist, now working on fracking, Francis Leader. Also, former US Army Psychological Warfare Officer, Scott Bennett. Also, our studio engineer, Dave Bazenko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk, and you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.